Audi.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. For this episode, I am sitting at my kitchen table in Brighton. Yes, I did check it was legal, with a man I actually went to school with in Spain. Please forgive the few audio bumps and the noise of the children in the background. They do calm down after a while, I promise. And I think because I was so excited to finally be interviewing someone face to face after lockdown easing a little bit here in the UK, I was also a bit rusty. Anyway, Hugh has a well-known festival called Into the Wild, as well as doing many other things. And he's one of the most well-travelled people I know. And I know you're going to absolutely love his stories. Into the Wild festival promoter Hugh Wynne grew up in his mother's hotel in Wales and then Spain. On this episode, Hugh and I talk growing up feral in Andalusia, hitching across Europe, dropping fish packing in the Netherlands to run off to Glastonbury, the Arabian Nights vibe of Cairo, the poetic side of being a London bin man, meeting Mother Teresa in Calcutta, meeting the Dalai Lama, studying Tibetan medicine in Scotland, hitching 2,000 miles through Nepal in the back of a truck, Tom Hardy at his festival, rewilding, den building, and so much more. So we are sitting in my kitchen and it is legal. We have checked because we are working. And I'm with Hugh, who actually I went to school with, which is very interesting. I was thinking of some of my memories of you from school earlier. And I think like many of us growing up in Spain, you're a little bit feral.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, that's why I became friends with your brother. So, yeah.
He was also quite feral.
Yeah. We used to have lots of fun. I think it was, you know, coming from Wales, where it was quite shut down in the winter in many ways, to going to Spain in school and, you know, having the beach 5 minutes away was just great, wasn't it?
We certainly were liberated, weren't we, in a
Absolutely.
Sense?
Absolutely. And in those days, you know, in Spain we had, you could just have a moped without a licence, 14, and no helmets. We were just like, yay, you know, health and safety, non-existent.
We were just out all night, weren't we, from a very young age.
We didn't go out till about 11, would you?
No.
Whereas in Wales, you'd be in bed by, you know, whatever.
And I love the way that our parents just sort of, because my parents, I mean, I know a lot of your mum is fantastic, but my parents are very sensible people. You know, they don't even drink, my parents, but they just seem to let us go feral. They seem to be quite happy to just go, hey, off you go, kids.
Yeah.
Enjoy yourselves.
Yeah. It was a fun place to exchange Wales for sure, you know. In fact, I think that was part of the got me into travelling and a lot more freedom in a way, you know, especially because it was so multinational, you know, people from all over the world. And even the school was quite feral in its own way, wasn't it, in those days? And the international school was basically, I think they could scrape up whatever teachers they could at the time. Yeah.
I remember some very clever teachers. Also quite a lot of drunk ones, many people having affairs,
yeah, I know.
Affairs with each other, and it was almost like they were the rejects from English schools,
yeah.
But they were good rejects.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like I got a reasonable education, do you?
I left school, I think it was 15, the temptations of the beach and stuff were just too much, so I didn't end up doing any exams or anything, which, you know, these days I think it's almost illegal. but yeah, it didn't matter.
They didn't kick you out, though?
No, I just left. I kind of just went off. I mean, I went back to Wales for a bit. And then I got a job in Gibraltar.
Did you?
Yeah.
This is your first foray into travel.
Yeah.
Across the border.
No.
From the south of Spain.
Yeah, I worked as a little commis chef in a hotel in Gibraltar for a while. And lived in La Linha.
I've got a brilliant travel story about you, which I think we'll get to after we start talking about the festival stuff, but I've got a travel story that directly involves you, and
really?
I don't know if you remember. Yeah, in fact, I'm pretty sure you won't remember. I mean, it's not a really significant one, but it was a story that I told for quite a while because it used to make me laugh. But anyway, let's talk a little bit about the festivals, because as we record this, it's the end of March, and where are we with festivals? Some of them are going ahead, and tell us first of all about your festival.
So I run a festival called Into the Wild, which is, I guess, the UK's largest nature-based well-being festival. When I say nature-based, I don't mean naked people running around. I mean people who want to come out into nature and enjoy things like wildcrafts and things like bushcrafts, fire making, you know, yoga, meditation, dance, singing, choirs, loads of different stuff. And we had lots of world music and speakers and people from, you know, from the kind of environmental networks, plus authors and all sorts of things. So, yeah, that was going really well. It built up to, we ran two a year, one in May, which was the first festival of the year in many ways, the old festival of Beltane, and that would be about 1,500. And then in August, bank holiday, we built up from about 500 to 5,000, and it was 1,500 of that were kids. So they would be running around like wild, making dens in the woods, and just, it was wonderful. And then it all stopped.
Everything stopped, didn't
it? Yeah.
So what's happening this year? I know a few festivals are trying to be back on, but I don't know how that's going so far.
I think most people don't really know. I think some of the larger corporate festivals like Reading and Leeds and that are kind of pushing it to go for it, and Boomtown, but they are in many ways full of teenagers who, let's be honest, are not so worried about it. They just want to get out there, you know. Whereas ours is quite a mixed audience of families and people of all ages, from little babies to 80-year-olds. You know, we have a whole range. So it's a little bit more complex for us. So we're hoping, we can't do the May Festival. We're hoping to do the August Bank Holiday, but much smaller this year if we do it. We're probably about the size of our Spring Festival. But in the last year of lockdown, normally I would travel a lot around the world, especially in the spring still, and I couldn't. So I live out in the countryside near Lewes, and spent every day out on my bike or walking in the local landscape. And there's a famous quote by an American poet called Gary Snyder, which says, "Become famous for 5 miles." So it's like getting to know your local, the natural world around you, you know, your local landscape. So I started discovering where the frogs live and where the swans hang out and where the buzzards are and the deer, and just really got to know the local landscape. But also I realised how much has been lost, you know. So something like in the last 40 years, we've lost something like 60% of our wildlife through a lot of intense agricultural farming. So many reasons, you know. And so it felt sad, you know, that we're at that place. So I was really thinking about this and started researching and reading, and I was quite passionate about rewilding. And there's a brilliant rewilding estate, probably the most important one in the UK at the moment, called Knepp Castle in West Sussex. And I go there and around and realised I wanted to do something, rather than just recycling a few plastic cups, which is great, mm-hmm. but I wanted to feel empowered to do something, and especially around bringing back wildlife and nature. So I set up this project called Wilderlands, and now we are running a whole series of wild weekends, which are much smaller. So it's like a wild campsite. Wild's got all the nice, you know, facilities and stuff, but it's focusing on bringing families out into nature. You know, 100 people to 150 maximum, maybe less, depends. And we have workshops, lots of wild crafts, lots of archery, lots of fire making, lots of den making, lots of yoga, meditation, all sorts of things, and lots of great speakers, actually. I've, in fact, just invited David Attenborough.
Have you?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I wrote to
him. Can I come to that one?
You have to write a handwritten letter to him if he'll respond.
Oh my God, my handwriting's awful.
I know.
I'd love to get him on the podcast, but I fail at the handwriting. I can barely hold a pen these days.
I know.
Shakes. It looks like I'm 100.
It took me about 4 hours to write a 2-page letter. I had to keep writing it, you know, so it was like, you know, you could read it.
He wants handwritten letters. I mean, he's David Attenborough. He can have it in gold, as
exactly.
far as I'm concerned.
Exactly.
So has he said yes?
Well, it's just gone off the last weekend.
Oh, okay, so we'll see.
But we do have some amazing other authors and stuff, like there's an amazing author called Jay Griffiths, who wrote a book called Wild. We've got the great conservationist Alan Watson Featherstone, and the great mythologist Dr. Martin Shaw, and all sorts of people coming along. So each weekend is slightly themed, from some about folklore mythology, some about, there's a yoga camp, some about rewilding, some just pure wild weekends.
That sounds amazing. And when do they start? How do we find out about this?
So they start the end of May, hopefully. Everything is hopefully. This all could be just like a great idea that, you know, dissolves like everything else. But hopefully they start, I think, the weekend of May the 21st, and they go right till September the 23rd. And you can find out about them on our website, which is wilderlands, all one word, .co.uk.
Now, I saw, talking of famous people that in your festivals, I saw Tom Hardy went to one of your festivals.
He turned up at one of our festivals.
I just saw his photo. I was like, oh my God, I'll go to the next one.
All the women were just like melting. It was a hot weekend. And he turned up with, you know, he had his top off. He was with his children, and he was wandering around. And some of the pictures I saw after of the women's faces, because he was very kind in taking photos, and they were just like, well, what can I say, just literally gobsmacked. And, you know, it was, people were like, this is the best day of my life. And then I put the photos out, and, you know, for the next year advertising, people would book just thinking Tom Hardy was going to turn up, you know.
It's an attraction enough for me. He lives in the Sussex countryside, I think, doesn't he?
Does he?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's probably why he was there.
Well, the thing about our summer festival, this is not the same with the World Weekends, but the summer festival, we do it, that we try and have it alcohol-free, as in we don't have any bars. I mean, that was partly to encourage a sense of well-being, but also so we know what festivals are like. Often festivals go, get out of it, wake up with a hangover on Saturday, you know, and it's great. But with ours, with lots of workshops, we wanted to encourage the parents, and, you know, so dad wake up and mum on Saturday and feel fresh and go and do workshops with the kids and hang out. And that pretty much happened. And Tom doesn't drink, so I think, you know, that appealed to him.
All right, well, I'll make a date for Tom and everyone. I'll be doing that. That sounds brilliant. I watch you closely on social media, and our photography is amazing, really, really amazing. But we need to get onto your travel personally, because that's what this podcast is about, exploring life stories through travel. And so I'll start with what I remember about your travels. So it was a month past my 16th birthday that I moved from the Costa del Sol to Spain, to Brighton, sorry, where we are right now, in a cyclical something serendipitous, I can't even think of the words, and I bumped into you walking down the street in Kensington Gardens. I was like, hey, my goodness, you know, we went to school together, like, how are you? And then I kept on bumping into you, like, wherever I went. I mean, I didn't go many places at that point, but I do remember bumping into you in London and bumping into you in about 5 or 6 different places in Brighton. I mean, looking back, you know, Brighton is a small town, and that sort of happened. But every time you'd been away travelling and then come back, and then I said to you, God, this is amazing. If I went to India, I'd probably bump into you there. And since I wasn't a big traveller at the time, I was a bit young and, you know, hadn't done that much travelling, but I did later go to India, didn't bump into you. But about 6 months after I said that to you, I was like, I know, if I go to India, I'm sure I bumped into you there. I was in the pub that I was working in, the Pig in Paradise on Queen's Road at the time. And some people had just come back from India, and they were showing us their photos. You know, that's how long ago, their actual hard photos. And they were showing me their photos, and there you were, sitting in the photo. I was like, oh my God, that's so funny, because the last thing I said to you was, I bet if I went to India, I'd bump into you there. And there you were, sitting in the photos. So I know you've had some tremendous, tremendous travels. Where did it all start?
Wow, I think the first place I went after working in Gibraltar is I met these quite wild bunch of English travellers living in Spain, and they were going over to Morocco. So I went over to Morocco, I must have been about 16, and I loved it, but I find Morocco quite daunting. It's quite, it was quite hassly in those days, you know. So that started a taste for travelling, and then I met a girlfriend in Brighton, actually, and we travelled. So we went to Spain to see my mum, and then we hitchhiked all the way across, up through Spain, right through Barcelona, down through the south of France, to Italy, up through Austria, Switzerland, back round, you know, working, and just, we didn't even have a tent, we just went wherever we went. And we you know, we'd hitchhike in those days, which doesn't seem to happen much anymore, but we just went on the road and met some incredible people. I remember in Italy once we met this, we were out in the Alps, and this guy picked us up, and he was a priest from Argentina, and he took us to his brother's farm, and they, you know, let us have a room for a couple of nights and wine and grapes, and, you know, we had loads of stories like that. I remember getting a lift one night off the only one-legged lorry driver in France, who apparently he'd written to the president of France and they helped make a lorry that he could drive. You know, great little stories. So Europe, and then I travelled around the UK for a while. In those days, there was the kind of free festival scene in Glastonbury. So I went to Glastonbury for my first time. Oh, before that, I'd gone to live in Holland for a while, that's it. And then I went to Glastonbury, and Glastonbury blew my mind because it was just like, wow. And in those days, Glastonbury was, honestly, turned up at the fence, and there were some scousers there. We dug a hole underneath, and you paid them a fiver, and you were in. And, you know, and that's how it was. And it was just like a medieval world to me then.
You know. Didn't you run off? I'm sure I've seen you post it on social media that when you were in Holland doing something to do with the tulips or something like that, didn't you like meet some people and just sort of go off to Glastonbury for a weekend and never come back?
Yeah, did you remember that?
Well, yeah,
that's literally what happened. I was working in a fish factory in Holland with an Irish girl called Marilyn. And we heard about this thing called Glastonbury. We didn't really know what it was, but it was on the next weekend, and we really wanted to go. And we didn't have enough money, so she came up with this plan to tell them that her brother or someone was really not well, and we had to get back to Ireland. And they gave us our wages, and so we jumped on a Euro coach at the time, whatever it was, and then hitchhiked to Glastonbury and then got in. And I think by the time we got in, we had about £10 each left. And it was a funny story because I put to my tent, and I was in a pair of shorts, I remember, and a T-shirt and maybe a light jacket, and went off and couldn't find my tent again for 3 nights. But I met some people and they looked after me. And on the Monday, when a lot of the tents had gone, I found my tent. I never saw Marilyn again. And there was some work there clearing up Glastonbury. And there used to be these big teams where this kind of ex-sergeant guy called Brian used to command everyone, and in big lines, and you'd go across the fields collecting the rubbish. And it would be 3 or 4 weeks' work, and you'd get paid well and fed. And so I did that. And yeah, my life changed then. I just started travelling around, going to festivals and stuff. And then I met Joe in Brighton, and we... Then that's it. What it really changed is I went to Egypt, and I, with a friend I'd met in Brighton, and I absolutely loved Egypt in those days, and I still miss Egypt because things have changed a lot now. But Cairo was just the most magnificent place, you know, so kind of Arabian Nightish with the falafels and the hookah pipes and the mad traffic and the people, and it was just incredible, and it was cheap. And we travelled around Egypt, took a felucca up the Nile, and then went to the Sinai and went snorkelling in the coral reefs. And it was a kind of almost like an enlightening experience for me going there. I absolutely loved it. And when I got back, we moved to London, and I just wanted to travel, so we saved up. And I actually worked that winter in London on the rubbish bins with this, they had kind of private company, but we'd go round on a Friday night, start work, and work all weekend over the nights, and we'd drive through central London, and you'd watch the life of London from the nightclubs and the people, and then suddenly, you know, for the early hours, the kind of remnants in Trafalgar Square and the people being ill, and then suddenly the quietness of London with foxes, and then, you know, and I saved enough money, and we went to India for the first time when I was about 21.
That's the most poetic description of being a binman I've ever heard.
It was pretty harsh at times, but...
But you're like that, aren't you? You're very much like that with your travels. You're spiritual, and you've done all the stuff I wish I'd done, but actually my travels have all been, like, paid for luxury hotels by publications and stuff, which, is, you know, has its own merits.
Definitely.
I've never slung on a backpack and gone, you know, around Nepal, which, you know, you have, but actually I don't even know if you had a backpack. Like, in my mind's eye, I see you with, like, you know, your pockets full and sort of bare feet almost. You seem to have had some very profound travels.
Yeah, I think I did. You know, it's funny because I lost my dad when I was very young. I was brought up in Anglesey in Wales, in this old kind of mansion house come monastery that my mum turned into a hotel. And my dad died when I was six. And that kind of had quite a profound impact on me of, like, you know, wondering what it's all about. And I think that stirred it on. And don't get me wrong, these days I'll stay in nice places, you know, and I don't go for so long, and I really, really appreciate that opportunity. So that first time in India, talking about that, we were travelling for 6 months, and I think we had about £400 each, literally. But we worked in an orphanage for street children, and we worked in Calcutta, Mother Teresa's home for destitute and dying, and met Mother Teresa in the, and went to Dharamsala, met the Dalai Lama. We had, you know, we were doing all the kind of classic spiritual cliches in some ways, but, you know, it was a wonderful experience. And we stayed with the British High Commissioner, funny enough. We were staying in quite cheap places, let's just say that. And, you know, when I first arrived in India, we stayed in this really cheap place, and I was almost in tears because there was, like, rats in the toilet and stuff, and I just wanted to go home. I literally was like, no. 6 months later, when I left, I was in tears because we'd had such an amazing time. But my girlfriend Jo's mum at the time was quite a well-known sculptor, and she sculpted the British High Commissioner's parents. And so she wanted to come and visit us and got in touch with him. And so when she came, we didn't know, but we turned up at the airport, and there was a bomb-proof Daimler there with a little British flag and, you know, all the bearers and stuff, and the High Commissioner with big flowers for her. And they said, get in the back. You're coming to stay in the High Commission. And it was the week after Princess Diana had stayed there. When, you know, that famous photo. So we stayed in the room that she stayed in. So, like, the week before, from being in this kind of vagabond, you know, from Goa to all around, we suddenly had our own bearers and our own, you know, headed paper. And we were having dinner with the ambassador from Malaysia and Burma. And it was just like...
I know, having seen you at the time, I can imagine in the nicest possible way, you look like crap, you know, you were like travellers and straw sticking out your hair.
Well, the great thing in India, you can go to the barbers for a pound, and they will shave you and, you know, tidy you up. And that was quite incredible. And then we went to Ladakh, which has been one of my favourite places, which is... right in the northwest of India, and it used to be part of Tibet, but luckily it became part of India, and it's an ancient Buddhist kingdom. And whilst we were there, Joe's brother died, and his soon-to-be wife, in a mountain accident in Canada. He was a doctor, and we had been walking in this a really remote valley called Zanskar, which was a 3-week walk of a few hundred miles. And we'd gone, just me and her, and one guy with a horse who carried all our stuff. And we had a parachute. We stayed in, we didn't even have a tent, an old parachute that they dropped supplies in. And we'd walk through this vast, uninhabited, mainly remote valleys. And when we got through 3 weeks, I mean, those days, no phones or anything, you know. We phoned home on the monthly call and found out this had just happened. So within days, we were rushed to Delhi to the High Commissioners again and flown straight home. So it was quite shocking, from being in this really remote kingdom to within a week back into this funeral and this dreadful experience, really.
To Canada, you flew to Canada?
No, he was British, but they'd gone on holiday there, so we're back in the Midlands. And, yeah, it was quite full on. But we went back to Ladakh the year later, because a funny thing happened. There used to be a nightclub. There is a nightclub under the arches under Charing Cross, and there used to be quite a famous night called Mega Tripolis. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. Heaven.
And they used to invite people like the famous science terrorist McKenna, who was a science of psychedelics, and Allen Ginsberg, the famous Beat poet, and they were all there one night. I remember we were working there, and there was this little Ladakhi traditional doctor called Amchi Smanla, and he was talking about his, you know, seventh generation traditional medicine place out in the middle of nowhere. And he was so sweet, but he was so overwhelmed by all these hippies in these kind of like, you know, looking for this kind of psychedelic speakers and stuff. And I just really felt for him. And I went up and spoke to him. And I said, I'll come and visit you. And I did. And we're still really good friends. And I studied Tibetan medicine for 5 years after that.
Yeah. Where did you study? Tell me about studying Tibetan medicine.
So I studied with him and his some traditional healers, doctors, whatever you want to call them, in Ladakh. And then when I came back to the UK, there was a Tibetan monastery in Scotland called Sami Ling, with an amazing set up by Akong Rinpoche, who sadly passed away about 5 years ago. But he was an incredible man and a doctor as well. And he has done incredible charity work across the world, and he so inspired me. So he set up a Tibetan medicine course, and I studied there every year, and still travel to India every year. Traveled across Tibet. We hitchhiked 2,500 miles across Tibet to the most remote mountain, Mount Kailash, which is the most sacred mountain for Buddhists, Hindus, and Jains. And we did it without permits, in the back of trucks, one summer. And it was a most incredible journey. It was just vast, open, wide, and the most remote I've ever been. And we got put in a Chinese police cell one night for going in the wrong area. And we hung out with nomads, and I lost a lot of weight whilst out there because I got quite ill. But we did it for a month. And we hitchhiked back. And we got into Nepal, I'll never forget this. We got back into Nepal and we got across the border, and there was a classic Nepali chai shop place. And Nepalese are one of the most lovely people in the world. And I hadn't, you know, I could never eat, I still can't eat noodles because I'm so ill. And they had egg and chips on the menu.
Thank God.
Oh my God. I had egg and chips and beer, cold beer, and it was the best meal I've ever had in my entire life. You know, it was like, and then we met this American guy, this crazy American guy, and we hitchhiked back to Kathmandu on top of a bus. So we sat on top of the bus drinking beer, going around the mountain valleys, you know, the sun pouring through the pines, and it was just, I'll never forget it. And so we out in the middle of Tibet, the Tibetans out in that area, they hardly wash and stuff, you know, because it's so remote and there's no bathrooms or anything. You know, it's not Airbnb culture. And so we were looking quite wild. I remember looking in the mirror when I got back to Kathmandu, and I was like skinny, like almost like blackened face because of the tan and the high altitude.
Because of sitting on the roof.
Yeah, and being out in this high altitude desert. And so I went to the barber's the next morning, and I, you know, got in there and I closed my eyes and he shaved me. And I'll never forget looking up in the mirror, and half my face was still brown and half it was kind of white where he'd shaved the beard, you know. So, yeah, some incredible journeys.
You could just disappear back in those days, couldn't you? I mean, you could actually disappear. People did disappear, never to return. But you could disappear for months on end and not be in touch.
I speak to my mum once every 3 months or something. There was no internet, there were no mobiles. The odd phone call, the odd letter at post return. You'd have to say, write to me at this post office in 3 weeks if it got there, and then you'd get this little letter, and you know, and it would be quite precious. And she still kept some of those letters. And there was a certain beauty and naivety to all, I think, in those days, because you weren't constantly telling everyone what you're doing, and the kind of slightly narcissistic culture we live in now. Look at me, look at me. There was, you know, I hardly got any photos of those days, which is a shame. I've got some really beautiful ones, but, you know, you never know what you get. You take them and hopefully they come out okay, you know. But, most of it lives in the memories. So, yeah.
It's been wonderful that you've been able to make this
passion and life actually into a, you know, a working part of your life, which is, you know, I'm guessing it doesn't take a genius to work out that all this is leading up to, you know, creating the festivals and the life you've created for yourself.
Yeah, I think it was, and it was being out in some of these remote parts of India and Tibet, and I visited quite a lot of these kind of Sufi festivals and stuff in India, which were these kind of gatherings out in the world with these beautiful devotional singers and stuff, and it, you know, it can't help but touch you. You know, I remember this 80 odd year old blind woman singing it as dusk arises about falling in love with the beloved, or, you know, and so spiritually it's very raw and real, you know, it's very kind of embedded with the landscape and the culture, and it really touched me a lot. And in Egypt was the same, and, you know, I travelled in Australia, New Zealand, more recently over the years in Thailand, which I absolutely love. In America a lot as well, actually. I love the Midwest in America. I've travelled quite a bit around Arizona and Utah and those places, and California, and I absolutely love that place. And no matter what anyone says, my experience of America, everyone I've met has been so friendly and lovely, and the landscape is just out of this world, you know. So
you forget, don't you, because you've got everything in America, and people laugh at Americans for having a small percentage of people who have passports, but they do have every type of landscape there.
Yeah.
You could possibly ask for. Obviously travel is important to many of us for other reasons, but, you know, you've got the snow, you've got the peaks, you've got the deserts, you've got the oceans, it's vast, really vast.
Yeah, and there's a big travelling culture in America, really, which is the RV travelling culture.
I love that.
Where people travel right across the states in these big, huge vehicles, like houses, and it's amazing. I mean, yeah, you could spend your whole life just travelling around America, couldn't you, you know? And for a lot of people it's easy because everyone speaks, you know, similar in language, that, you know, and they love English. Well, my experience, they're very open to English people. Mm-hmm. You know, Welsh, English, they seem to think Welsh is English, but that's fine.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, no, I've loved everywhere. One of the places I've loved being is Iceland. I've been a couple of times. With my daughters, I've got two daughters, and when they were 14, I said to them both, let's choose somewhere to go. So with my eldest, Shakira, we went to Iceland and had a week there. It was amazing, driving around Iceland. What an incredible place. And my younger one, Isla, we went to New York for a few days, and that was just fantastic as well, you know. So, yeah. I think that's the one thing I really do miss about the lockdown and that as well, although it's been wonderful to explore this country more, and I've always have done, but, you know, even more, is the ability to just travel. To me, you know, we took that for granted so much, just being able to jump on a plane, you know, and
also, we're all separated. I say this so often on TV and radio when I'm doing, you know, travel updates, but we're all separated from people we love, and that's the very difficult part. It'd be beautiful to go to, you know, off exploring India or Nepal or anywhere right now, but I imagine the one thing you really want to do is hop on a plane, like I do, to Malaga and see your mum.
Yeah, I haven't seen my mum for, what is it, 18 months now, and she had COVID, and she's 82, and she got through it. She's quite a, you know, powerhouse. And she was really inspiring, because the first lockdown in Spain was quite hardcore, and so she decided to write her life story, and it's a wonderful story, and it's a great legacy to have for her grandchildren and maybe their children, you know, to see her life. She was brought up in really real poverty in Wales after losing my granddad, her dad, who was trying to save the King of Norway on a ship, HMS Glorious, and they got torpedoed, and I think it was the biggest casualties of a warship in the whole war, and he died. And my nan, who was a wonderful woman, I loved her so much, travelled with two very young young babies across, because they were stationed in Malta, Valletta, across Europe, and got back to Wales. And they lived, because he was Welsh, in mid Wales, rural Wales, in a very small house, no electricity, toilets outside. You know, my nan used to gather the parachutes, they used to drop the food to make knickers and underwear for them. It was really extreme. So my mum worked really hard and then bought this hotel and then moved to Spain. And she's had an incredible life. So
I've read it.
Have you?
Yeah.
It's called A Pickled Past.
I should have it. Next time I get to Malaga, I'll have her on the podcast because she's absolutely wonderful. And her story about, you know, bringing you and your... I know you've got Caris, haven't you? Caris, your sister...
Kerry and Emma,
that was it. I never knew them as much as I knew you, but I can visualise Kerry really well. She had all that blonde hair, didn't she?
Yeah.
You know, your father died when you were six, and presumably the others, are they slightly older?
Well, my sisters.
Yeah.
Emma's 2 years older, and Kerry's 2 years younger.
You can't imagine what your mum went through, but she's such a strong woman, and she's been an incredible traveller as well, hasn't she? So
she has, yeah.
I should get her on the podcast, but yeah, well, I'll promote the book as well. But she's wonderful, really wonderful.
She after her husband David died in Spain, was it 15 years ago now? I can't remember the exact how long it is, but she, yeah, like, you know, she started working with the theatre even before that and started travelling, taking people everywhere, across Morocco to Egypt a few times, to Iceland, to all across Spain, you know. She started really travelling again and loved it. She went to India by herself in, what, 78 or something. Then she went to Nepal by herself and she was like just, you know, wandering around and meeting people and just really kind of going for it. I never thought when I was in India younger that my mum would deal with India, and it's, you know, the hardcore.
It can be hard, yeah.
But she did, and she loved it. She actually loved India, and I was really surprised.
I can see where your spirit comes from, and hers. I think she's been inspired by you as well, you know, because her generation weren't necessarily travellers, they were just getting by, you know, but then she's got that spirit, and she's been inspired by you. And I hope it sounds a little bit patronising, because I'm younger than you, and only a couple of years, I'm imagining, but because of my brother, you're my big brother's friend, but it's really nice to, like, look back and see how you've grown, you know, from that sort of kid that just went off and did stuff, and actually you've carried on going off and doing stuff, but it's sort of it's worked out really well, which is lovely.
Yeah, well, it's funny you say that, because when I left school at 15 and I started traveling, my mum was like really not happy about it, and for what you know, who is this kind of vagabond child that I've had, what's he doing with his life, you know, why isn't he getting a job in a bank or, you know, whatever it is. And for a few years she was really wondering. I think she was quite worried, but I always trusted and I loved my life, and it wasn't always easy in those days, because, you know, I didn't have much money. And now with the festivals and what's happened and some, you know, some of the wonderful things that's happened, that she is actually quite proud of it, and she's inspired by it, which is really good, because it turned around, because it, you know, it could go,
it could have gone the other way,
could have gone anywhere.
It could have gone the other way, you know, absolutely. You and my brother could have gone the other
yeah,
way.
Yeah, exactly. Who knows?
All of us probably could have gone the other way.
Yeah, and now it's worked out good. You know, I've got a wonderful partner, Caris, who's doctor of anthropology, and she's been inspirational in helping me get the festivals together and them really taking off. You know, so, and I love what I do. I really feel happy that I've had this opportunity, because that could have gone either way. I, you know, the festivals can stop at any moment, like we know now with the pandemic, you know, it easily could go bust. But I think the travelling, and especially in places like India and stuff when it was more challenging, helps you to find ways of innovation and to look, even in what might seem the darkest moments, opportunities. So for me, the Wilderlands has really been inspiring, and I've been reaching out to some really fascinating people through it, who, you know, from all walks of life. And so one of the things that happened with Wilderlands, interestingly, recently, I spotted this. I was reading a book called The Last Wilderness, which is a Brighton author called Neil Ansell. It's really worth getting on board, because he travels around the world, and he's a great travel writer and nature writer. And his book, Last Wilderness, is about the most remote part of Britain, the western part of Scotland, especially Nuadhaar peninsulas and stuff. And it's a place of sea otters and golden eagles, and you know, it's a beautiful part of the world, and it's pretty wild for Britain. And I was reading this book on Audible, listening to it, and I just felt really inspired to know about this place, because he said he travelled all over the world, but he loves this area. So I was looking on there, and I spotted some land for sale there, which, you know, which was incredible, overlooking the ocean. And I really felt like this could be the beginning of some kind of rewilding project. And so in lockdown, I got permission to go and see it, because you can see property, and drove 2 days there. It's a long way, actually. Got to my friends in Cumbria, which was allowed to stay in, permission. 7 hours, then it was another 7 hours. You know, it's like, my God, Scotland's a big place.
Yeah.
And went to this land, and it was so beautiful. But I stayed there 2 nights, came back, and just realised it was so far for me living in Sussex. And so I said to them, you know, I love it, but it's too far. And then I was writing to this wonderful guy, Alan Watson-Feverson, who set up a charity called Trees for Life, replanting the ancient Caledonian forest of Scotland. They've planted over 3 million trees. It's just like an incredible guy. Inviting him to come and talk at one of our wild weekends. And I said to him, I've been in Scotland. And he said to me, whereabouts? And I said, this area. And he said, oh, my wife's got a caravan right there. And it's a really remote area. There's not many houses. There were no roads there till the 70s and no electricity till the late 80s, you know. And the land I saw has got this waterfall, and right near to the waterfall there's 2 or 3 caravans, and it's his wife's caravan. And he said, wow, what are you doing there? And I said, about this land, but it's too far. And he said, well, why don't we join up together? Because that area is one of the last remaining parts of the ancient Western Atlantic temperate rainforest, which is really endangered. Why don't we set up a pilot project to regenerate and rewild it together? And so we're at the very early stages of setting up a project to do that with the temperate rainforest.
Oh, amazing.
And it looks like we might have some backing already to do it all. So it's been really amazing, you know, when you follow your heart and seeing what happens. You know,
you just never know when your next step is going to be in life, do you, your next stage in life. I love that. Well, I'm going to ask you my last question now. And my last question is always about music, because I believe that music and travel go very much in hand in hand. And as you know, music's meant a lot to me and my family, and probably to you as well, I'm guessing. If you had to choose one song that reminds you of a memorable time and place of travel, I mean, that could be in this country as well. What is that song, and what is your memory?
Wow. Well, I would say my favourite singer of all is an Indian classical singer called Kumar Gandhavara. And I can't remember the name of the song, but any of his music is just incredible. He was a child prodigy in Mumbai, and of the classical tradition, and he was going to be the next big thing in Indian classical music. And he got TB, and he couldn't have to stop singing. So he was told to go and live out in Madhya Pradesh, in the countryside. And he did. And he would sit there every day, and these wandering folk singers like you get in India would come and sing at his door, and he'd listen to them. And he kind of fell in love with this music. Anyway, later on they found that they cured his TB, and he could sing again. And he brought together, he was the first real thing to bring together the Indian classical tradition, which is quite strict and a bit like ours, with the folk tradition. And his music is absolutely beautiful. And yeah, it's just something else.
Thank you so much, Hugh, and thank you so much for listening to The Big Travel Podcast. Do give us a review on your podcast app, whatever you're using, if you can, and we will be back with more very soon.